Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org. And you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page. This year's Jazz, Rhythm, and Blues Festival at Kenosha Harbor Park is Saturday, August 20th. Rebirth Brass Band headlines, also New Blue, featuring Carly Sky, daughter of legendary blues artist Buddy Guy. Proceeds benefit the Mary Lou and Arthur F. Mahone Fund, promoting healthy lifestyle initiatives and educational and career opportunities for all students. Tickets at MahoneFund.org, a supporter of WGTD. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Marlo Harmon, a lifelong Racine resident who's currently employed as an addiction counselor at Racine Correctional Institution. And now, here's today's host.
And good morning and welcome. I'm Jim McClure, and our guest this week is Harold Freestead of the Kishwaukito Nature Conservancy in Williams Bay. And Harold, thanks for joining us.
Jim, thank you. It's a pleasure.
You strike me having just spent the past couple hours with you walking the preserve areas. It's kind of the Johnny Appleseed of our area. How did you get involved with the Nature Conservancy, and when did it start?
Well, I was village president back in 1989, and the first thing on my plate as chairman of the Plan Commission as well was a development for the area. It was the second or third in a line of developers. Actually, back in the late 60s, the village had actually agreed to a development, which would have included a 30-acre marina in there. And several people ran for the new board that was coming up that year and fought the project, and they actually took and locked up the plans and did not let the developer move forward. Eventually, the village was sued for that, but it was money well spent because it saved it for us 20 years later to... After entering into the process of the development again, and after we listened to the developer for 2 years, I checked with the Southeast Wisconsin Regional Planning Commission. I said, is there any way anything could be developed on this without definitely harming the environment? And they said, absolutely not. I had found out that the developer was considering selling it. It was a little recession at that time. And move forward, and at a meeting we decided we would go into negotiations, see if we could buy it. It started out at $2 million. We got it down to $1.5 million, and in 4 months we owned it.
And to give people a perspective on that, the Nature Conservancy is right along the Geneva Lake shore, and $1 million is a pretty good value compared to what you'd pay for lakefront property now, isn't it?
Well, for sure. I mean, I received a lot of criticism at the time, spending $1.5 million, but it's 230 acres on Lake Geneva when you can pay as much as $40,000 for a shoreline foot. And this completed, we had a previous board that did the beautiful lakefront park, but it stopped short of terminating the leases for the businesses on the lake. So there were many things, lots of buoys on the lake and everything, so we... Before we even did Kishwaukito, we had terminated those leases. We got rid of all the piers and buoys on the lakefront, so our lakefront in Williams Bay is wide open, beautiful vista when you walk along the shore path, and just making it very special. And then we did build the two piers with the, I think it's a total of 89 slips, but we saved the village on that as well because we did not pay for it out of taxes. We had everyone renting a slip pay 5 years up front, and that paid for the project. And so things just went along quite well. Next thing is Kishwaukito, and then we also bought, there used to be grain elevators on the lakefront. The year after we buy the Kishwaukito property, we had to come up with a lot of money to buy that property when the individual that owned it had passed away and it became for sale. So that was the final thing in totally clearing up all of the debris and things after the departure of the railroad back in 1967. But we have to remember that the railroad being there was one of the things that made Kishwa Key. Its timing is everything. That made it available, because until that was abandoned, who would want to build a subdivision or a development behind the railroad and look through that down to the lakefront? So it's a timing is everything thing, and I just happened to have a great board that was willing to move forward and buy the property.
Located about 5 miles out of Lake Geneva and bordered to the north by the Mercy Walworth Hospital Medical Center, and by the south by the Geneva Lake Shore, the Williams Bay Municipal Pier. And it was the Chicago and Northwestern. It was both a passenger and a freight train that came through this area and through where the preserve is now, right?
Well, that's true. And one of the reasons for that there's several reasons. Actually, the giant refractor telescope that came up, the tube came up from the Columbian Exposition in Chicago of 1893, and it was brought up by train right down to the lakefront in Williams Bay and then hauled up to where the observatory was being built. But also, back at the turn of the previous century, there were 50 of the large boats that you see. You know, we still have that at Lake Geneva Cruise Line, the Polaris and those 75-foot steam yachts that were owned by all the wealthy people that had estates around the lake. They were built in Racine, Wisconsin, and they had to get down to the lakefront. The depot stopped in Lake Geneva about 6 blocks from the lake, so that did not make sense for trying to offload a boat. So they paid to have the line extended down to Williams Bay, and it was essentially about 100 feet from the water's edge, and that way they were able to offload these large boats. And then they also took advantage of that and harvested ice all winter long and would send ice back to Chicago to be stored in straw and that to provide refrigeration, ice boxes and kind of a means of air conditioning where they could have it in their house with vents and fans blowing over it. So a lot of different things, brought that. But again, that made Kishwa Kido possible because it was there. And there were several other things. I mean, actually, there was an Arabian horse farm on there. The Harrises that had one of the beautiful mansions on the lake, looked like Monticello. Their son Albert, he was loved the outdoors, there were Arabian horses brought to the Columbian Exposition in 1893. He bought these horses and brought them up to this property, and it was called the Kima Pony Farm. And actually, Albert Harris started the Arabian Horse Registry, which is now in Colorado, but you can go home right now and put on your laptop and go to the Arabian Horse Registry and trace horses back to this property. And then at Geneva National, that wooded area to the west of the entrance, the reason that's a wooded area and not developed is that's a deeded Arabian Horse Cemetery. So there's a lot of history that goes along with Kishwa Kido.
And it was never, beyond that, it wasn't a farm. It was mostly open land going back to glacier times or Indian Potawatomi times?
Well, again, before it was farmed, it was just farmed to provide feed and things for the horses, but in order to do that, they had to tile the whole property. No, previously, the whole property was a wetland. And, in fact, before Highway 67 went through, the wetland extended all the way across where the Lions Athletic Field is. And so everything was changed. It was our mission at one point to restore the property to pre-settlement conditions. But that's not possible because it's not the same as it was then. And, in fact, that plateau area along Highway 67 that we cleared all the box elder off of there about 10 years ago, that is all fill. Back about 45 years ago, they upgraded Highway 67, and they would dig down 20, 30 feet in some areas to get to good, solid structure that they could put the road on. And so all that fill went into Kishwa Kido. And all of that fill went into there, so whenever we plant trees there, we dig up blacktop and all kinds of other things. But that moved the stream back, the Southwick Creek that came from where the gravel pit is up there. Well, part of it, there's a fork in it. There's the part that comes under the road, and then the part when we took our walk this morning, and I mentioned the wetland at the north end, that's the mouth of the creek up there as well.
As you walk that area, it seems like it's not one but three or four different places. Can you describe some of the variety that's in there and why that variety is there?
Well, that's what is so nice about this park is that it is so diverse. We actually were members of the Chicago Wilderness Society, and they always have to send a representative out to check the property that's their members. And they were so pleased to see this because they said so often they go out and it's a farm field you make into a prairie, or you know, and it's not diverse. We have two wetlands. We have the wetland that still exists down by the lakefront, and then we have the one that we looked at today way at the north end. Plus, we have the two streams, the Southwick Creek that feeds spring-fed water into the lake and Harris Creek that really has not changed in 10,000 years. It starts just south, comes out of the ground just south of Calvary Church, and it goes down and comes out in the beach area there, and that's just beautiful, crystal-clear water. And that's why it was named. We had a naming contest. In fact, when we bought it, I wanted it was all zoned parkland at that time because they wanted to be able to sell it to recoup our money. So I thought, well, if we want to make this into what I would like to see in a nature area, we've got to do something about that. But I just lost my...
We were talking about the name, and I suppose how you came up with Chispoquito.
I formed a committee and named the park committee so we would get people thinking of it as a park. And so we came up with Chispoquito, and it became the Chispoquito Nature Conservancy. And Chispoquito loosely translates to it's Potawatomi for clear water or lake of the sparkling water. And we felt that with our wetlands intact, the only one still remaining of that significance on the lake, plus the two streams coming in, that was a very appropriate name for the property.
Yeah, I was reading that Chispoquito was the name the Indians originally gave Geneva Lake itself. And isn't this part of Williams Bay on the northwest portion of Geneva Lake? This was kind of the last undeveloped area on the lake, and still has some undeveloped shoreline pretty much as you walk along.
Well, that's one of the, you know, each community around the lake is unique. I mean, Lake Geneva is certainly the tourist mecca, and people come to the area because you all heard about Lake Geneva. Fontana has more, you know, businesses right on the lake shore, a lot of activity there. Williams Bay is a charming, laid-back community. And that's why when we were able to totally make the lakefront public after they had started the lakefront park, which is certainly a precious thing as well, it just added to the significance and charm of this village. And a lot of people are telling me all the time when they decided to retire and move up from the city, they would look at the other communities and then they would take a walk in Chispoquito and decided they wanted to live in Williams Bay. So it's done everything that I had hoped to do when we bought it.
We'll talk about some of the sites to be sure, but I'd like to start with the sounds. First of all, the incredible silence, and I'm not sure why that is, but it just seems like within 100 or 200 yards, you are all of a sudden in nature and hearing nothing but nature, despite two busy highways in the village, very, very busy surrounding it.
That is so true, and on our walk this morning, I always mention that when we're walking in the northeast corner, we're not that far from Highway 50, and so you do hear a lot of the traffic noise, but as soon as you get away from that area, it is total silence, and it's just the amount of vegetation, and here you're right in downtown Williams Bay, and back when we started the development, we talked with a landscape architect professor at the University of Wisconsin, Evelyn Howe. And she sent some graduate students down to help us with our master plan. And then 15 years later, she was still there, and I had one of our board members ask her if she could send some more students down to review what we've done and give us any additional advice. And they absolutely couldn't believe what we had done because we do it all with volunteers and donations. So we don't get a nickel from the village. We don't ask for it. And when we bought it, I said we would never come back for any more money. And they were just amazed that you're right in downtown Williams Bay. You got the lake and everything else, and you walk out there 100 yards, and it's just almost deafening silence. It's just wonderful. And I walk there almost every single morning of the year, and it's just a wonderful place, way to start the day.
Compare it, Harold, with some of the other some of the other areas. We have plenty of places to walk around here, hiking areas that are beautiful to go to, but talk about some of those areas in southeast Wisconsin and northeast Illinois, and again, what makes this area here unique.
Well, again, I did mention that I had walked all of them recently, and, you know, they're all beautiful. Everything, anywhere you can save acreage and keep it from being developed is wonderful. But again, the diversity that we've mentioned already in Kishwa Kito is so wonderful, plus our prairie. I mean, our 75-acre prairie is just something nobody else has to offer at this point, and that does take a long time. But I just had the feeling as I walked through the other places in that, I know we hire 3 summer interns every year. We have work days, at least 15 or 16 of them a year, starting in January. It's almost every weekend because that's when it's fun to go out and cut buckthorn when it's cold and it's not warm and buggy and everything. But you can see when you walk through Kishwa Kito the evidence of ongoing restoration, and that's what I've noticed at ours, more so than I did in other areas that I walked. But again, they're all beautiful. They're all, you know, a real asset to the southeast Wisconsin, and even the Kettle Moraine. I love to ski there and walk there, and it's just such a wonderful, wonderful thing that we were able to save that. But again, Kishwa Kito, what we've done in 25 years, 26 years now, and the ongoing evidence of our work is what really makes me feel good when I walk through it.
For people who want an introduction to the area, your Friday morning tours, I suppose, are a good way to start. Where does one go, and what will you experience during that time?
Well, that's something I started about, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. I had the interns do it originally, and then I thought, well, I should get out there and tell my story every week. And so I started out doing it at 7 in the morning and then 7:30, and people don't like to get up early. I normally, the other days of the week, I'm out there at 6:30. But some days we'll get 3 or 4 people. Other days I'll have 24. And after everyone's done the walk, they really enjoy it. I had a woman last week. She said, I've been walking here for years now. She said, I never knew as much as I learned today. So that's always makes me feel good, but I'm also getting the word out and letting people know what a precious asset we have here.
So that's every Friday morning at 8 o'clock, and this is the entrance on Highway 67, kind of kitty corner from the subway shop and down the hill from the police department.
Yes, that's true, and again, I do it every Friday starting the 1st of April right up through the end of October. But again, anyone wants to walk any other time, I'm out there at 6:30, 7 o'clock. If you have a group of people that you want to introduce to the project, I love it so much. I'll almost stop what I'm doing any time and take people for a hike out there.
I suppose for the layman's view, especially with a name like Conservancy, all you do, one would think, is sit back and let it grow. But there's actually quite a bit of work that goes into it. What did you start 26 years ago to get to where it should be, and what's the kind of yearly maintenance one goes through?
Well, that is the big problem because many groups, besides individuals, we get several groups that are very good to us and grant money every year. But their charters and that, they give money for restoration. So restoration is the first phase of it. But then nature abhors a void, and anywhere there's an open spot, she's going to put down whatever she's got. And so maintenance is as big as restoration. So I like to refer to it as ongoing restoration. It's because maintenance is kind of a negative term. You're just thinking of mowing trails and emptying the garbage cans. But maintenance is the secret to the whole thing, because if you don't continue. I was reading a thing the other day because we have so much Queen Anne's lace out there, and I was reading how to get rid of it, and said first thing you want to get rid of the flowers, because they found that a seed bank can last for up to 120 years if it's in a dark area where there's no sunshine in that. You clear it out, and all of a sudden these flowers have been sitting there that long. I knew. I thought it was like 7 to 10 years, but this 120 kind of astonished me. But it was from an environmental group that sounded, you know, like good information. But we found that because every year during the winter we've been clearing along the lakefront, getting rid of all the buckthorn. Nothing grows in a dense buckthorn forest because there's absolutely no sunlight that gets in there. As soon as we clear an area without planting a single seed, all of a sudden we'll have beautiful flowers popping up. And so, you know, that attests to that. But again, you have to keep going back because the buckthorn shoot here will come up, a buckthorn shoot there, even dogwood, which is good. But if you don't control it somewhat, it can just totally overtake an area. So it's ongoing. So the bottom line is the more we do, the more there is to do because you just can't restore an area and leave it and move on to another spot. You have to keep taking care of what you've done.
As a minimum, how many workers do you have out there? I was walking through the other day, went up to the tower area, the observation area, and saw a woman zipping around on a mower, keeping the path clean. And I noticed probably a half a day job just doing that much. How many people does it take on a weekly basis?
Well, we have three paid employees that we have during the summer. One or two. Actually, there's another gentleman that's a restoration ecologist that is full of knowledge, but he has many other sites that he works at, and he's a local resident, and he just fills in for us as he has time, especially more in the winter when these other places aren't doing that much. So we have a couple people part-time all winter long, and then 3.5 people in the summer. And then we have a work day once a month throughout the summer, but we get a fair attendance out for that. Starting in the fall, right after Labor Day, two nights a week, Monday and Thursday night, we go out at 4:30 for about an hour and a half, and I'll get 15, 20 people that will show up every time because this harvesting seed, it's almost like a quilting thing. You're out there, it's quiet, you get the beautiful fall colors, you're stripping the seed off, and you're chatting away, and it becomes a group in its own that just looks forward to that, and we do that right through the end of October. And then we get into November when the leaves are off the trees, and then it's much easier to cut down the invasive trees and things. And we'll have a couple meetings a month or a couple work days a month. But we get into January. I have them almost every Saturday for 3-4 hours in the morning. And weekly I'll get a dozen people out, sometimes as many as 18 people. And so it just makes you feel so good. There's no stress. Everybody loves what they're doing. You know, I'm in charge, but there's no boss out there. We all are doing what we love to do and love to be a part of. And what can be healthier for your disposition and your life? And it keeps me going, I know.
At the halfway point of our program, I should mention that this is Jim McClure on Community Matters here on WGTD FM, 103.3 in Lake Geneva, 101.7 in Elkhorn, 91.9 FM in Kenosha Racine, and on the internet, WGTD.org. Our guest this week is Harold Freestad, the chairman of the Kishwaukato Nature Conservatory. A remarkable several hundred acre preserve of swampland, prairie land. I'd almost call it a savanna, and woods, rolling woods you can walk through, and some bogs all along the side of Geneva Lake. Harold, let's talk some more about the seeding. Your seed comes for repopulating the prairie areas and the grasses and the flowers right from the prairie itself. And when you collect those seeds, how long can it take to populate a particular area? It sounds like some of this you've played Johnny Appleseed for a number of years.
Well, that's true, and that's why as the prairie gets better, it gives us a better variety of seeds, and in which a side shoot of that is, and a gentleman had told me this, that's an avid bird photographer, that the more variety of seeds you get, the more birds you get, and that has increased dramatically. But you see, we harvest the seed all fall, and then you get it spread out before it warms up in the spring. The freezing and thawing helps break down the shell on the seeds if you don't have time to clean them all. And we just go to other areas. When we do the, we did the Maine prairie, you hire somebody to spend 3-4 years killing it off and killing it off, and then when you plant the seed, then you have to mow it for a couple of years, and then following that, you do have to do a lot of burns, because burning is what allows the native plants all have deeper roots and can survive the burning, because that's what happened back when you had prairie fires. And so that's how you get rid of the invasive things and that. But so in certain areas, we'll just, without doing any killing off, tilling, or anything, we'll just keep throwing seed out there from, I had mentioned, I used to get this mentoring group from the high school, and they'd come out and just grab everything. And it wasn't just one selected seed, so you'd have garbage bags full of seeds. And as soon as they'd leave, I would go out in this one big open area that we had right across in the prairie and spread that around. And now, 10, 12 years later, this is almost as nice as the prairie that we spent a lot of money on planting. Because these seeds, you can pay as much as $200 an ounce for the seeds in that. It's nothing to spend $10,000 on a 20-acre area. So, and we're also doing, my wife passed away last October, and I had many friends of Kishwa Kido and friends of mine that appreciate what we've done out there, and it gave me quite a bit of money. And so we're doing a real high-grade seed mix on the northeast corner across from the prairie to make that as a nursery for seeds that we don't have at all right now. And so this is going to take, again, that we're actually killing that off right now. This has to be a more rapid thing than waiting for a passive restoration. And then the seeds will be planted this winter. There'll be some more the next year. Next year will be a lot of mowing to keep it down, because, again, that keeps the non-native plants under control. And so in a couple of years, 2-3 years, you'll start to see the benefits of that and the beautiful plants coming up. And we'll plant a lot of plugs as well, so that we get more instant results, because some of the seeds take 10 years to germinate.
Let's talk about trees. I noticed that on the far east part of the property, there is an arboretum. But you also remarked when we were walking today that in many ways the whole place is an arboretum. What is the mix of trees, and what are you trying to create here?
Well, my favorite day of the year in Kishwa Kido is Arbor Day. And again, after they quit farming the property, if you don't do anything, the first thing that comes up is box elder and buckthorn. And so what we've done on the western side, just east of Highway 67 and east of the creek, is we've thinned out the box elder forest, and then we planting hardwoods in amongst those, because that, doing it that way, it doesn't look like an arboretum with big fat trees in that. It forces the trees to grow tall as they would naturally in a forest setting, because they have to reach for the sun. And so we, every year on Arbor Day, the last 2 years specifically, we've had 500 students out there, 28 classes, 5 schools. In each class, we put two stakes out with their teacher's name on the school. They go find their stake. They go back. It tells them what kind of tree to plant there. They go back and get their tree. They walk back out, dig the hole, plant the tree, and they go back and get a couple buckets of wood chips and another couple buckets of water. And we plant 60 trees in a two-hour period, and it just so neat. And so the neat part about it, we'll be there later in the day finishing up things and that, and you see the students bringing their parents back down to show them the tree they planted. And we keep those temporary markers up there for about 6 months, so they can come out now and then and look at their tree. But this has been a very successful project. We do about 60 trees a year. Well, with additional memorial trees, we do more like 75 trees a year. And again, these are not seedlings. I'm 76. I can't wait for a 12-inch tall seedling to grow. Plus, it would just be deer food. So we plant 10 to 12-foot trees to get instant results. And so out of our donations, every year we spend about $6,000 on trees. And the trees we're putting in, you can go onto the University of Wisconsin website and find back when they surveyed the area, when it was becoming a state, back in 1843, they went through and surveyed. And wherever they would put a stake, if there was any significant vegetation, they would write down what was there. So lots of times when we're cutting back elder down, you know, so many people, a tree is a tree, and then, oh, you're destroying the environment again. And well, then we'll tell them the story about you can go on the line online, find this website, and we are planting, reintroducing the same trees that were there 150 years ago. And this happened last spring. The one gal was coming, and she'd been working. She grabbed a bag. She was picking up garbage along the creek and everything. And she, you know, she wanted to see who was in charge. And so I had stepped away for a bit. I came back, and there he is. And so she comes up, and I tell her the story. She drops her bag and starts helping us. So,
yeah, it does. It does seem to the layman destructive at first, especially if you only hang out down by the beach and the shoreline. That all of a sudden you see these vast areas where there is all these beautiful grasses and cat of nine tails, and all of a sudden it's all black because you've burned all of it. But that's part of how do you keep the mix between forest and swamp and glen.
Well, it's really the ground, you know, the water and the type of soil and that determines that. You know, we don't create that mix. Nature does that. We're just redoing it again to get the non-native plants out of there and to allow the normal plant communities that have been on the earth for millions of years.
And what looked like the driest part after the burn is now arguably the wettest. There is just a remarkable black, deep, moist soil, and then big green. Now, what's the big green stuff coming out of it near the boardwalk ways down by the shoreline?
Well, there's many cattails. There is a bad plant down there that we've just had an outfit come in and help us with herbiciding that particular plant. That's a Phragmites that grows 10, 12, 14 feet tall in there. But other than that, it's just many, many good native, you know, black-eyed Susans, the yellow coneflowers, all types of good wetland vegetation. And again, those seeds have just been sitting there dormant.
Now, this may be a vestige of railroad days, but there's a line of electrical wire that comes through down along the old rail line, and then it seems to cut east to west. And it seems like just recently you in the past year or so, you cleaned out that whole area. Was that in part for utility easements or to affect some of the other changes that you do as on a routine basis?
No, that was strictly the utility company. They have become more aggressive. They have an 80-foot easement under their power lines, and in the past they'd been letting them get overgrown, and then when they have a failure, it's a major project to get into to do the repair. In fact, and while they were working there this spring, I talked with them, and they said, no, they actually go out with helicopter. And every time there's a storm, they fly up and down the lines just to make sure there's no trees blowing over and that. So, no, it's their policy to be very aggressive about getting rid of anything over 8 feet tall. And so they cut all the trees down, and now some good stuff has come back and bad stuff, but they do have an environmental part of their agency that does come, and they will be killing off the bad stuff and planting some actually better things in there. And a lot of the stuff that's just come up naturally is very good. But I took a walk down that direction, and I found just a mass of this wild parsnip, which is not good. You touch that, and it takes the ultraviolet protection off your skin, and you blistered as soon as the sun hits it. And so I had my interns put their full suits on and long gloves, and they did a great job of pulling it all out. But so it's, again, it's just wherever there's a void, you know, nature abhors a void, and she'll put in there whatever is handy. So that's going to be a transformation for quite some time now, getting the good stuff growing and the bad stuff out of there. But no, that was strictly their project and policy of how they operate.
I noticed that on the map to the Kishwaukito Nature Conservancy, there is a railroad trail now. There you can walk roughly along where the railroad came in on the diagonal down from Lake Geneva. If one looks hard, can you see any evidence? Can you find a rail spike or a little concrete abutment that used to hold the signal? Is there anything left that says there was a railroad here?
Well, there actually, if you walk down there, there's a couple spots where there's a deep depression, which is like a stream had gone through there. And for quite some time, there was evidence of timbers and that were part of the bridge. I think most of that has disappeared now. But when you walk across Harris Road, there's a couple spikes in the blacktop, and those were spikes from when they had the railroad ties and that. And what's unique, we have done some clearing along there because railroads in general, they kind of had their own little environment, and special prairie plants and that would grow along that, more, you know, sandy cinder soil and things like that. And so you do want to clear along a rail, abandoned rail area. You can come up with some unusual native plants.
Yeah, was there like a roundhouse, or it came in on one rail, but the engines had to turn around? And
oh, yeah, that actually where the circle parking lot is, that's closest to Southwick Creek, and which would be on the west end of the lakefront. You know, there's two circle parkways, but that one on the west end, that essentially is where the turntable was until about 3-4 years ago when they did the lakefront road bed, and there had actually been about 12 pilings that were pushing up in the blacktop in that circle, and I think those pilings were the center of the turntable. I remember when they used to turn, I lived in Williams Bay for 73 years, so I remember when the railroad was there, and I always loved to catch turtles, and you'd watch, they would put the engine on there and turn the turntable around, and it would stir up the swampy soil at the bottom, and the turtles would start walking around, and so I'd go catch them, and it was you know, a very different setting back then. There were outhouses sitting right out in the wetland, and
well, now there's birdhouses, and I understand there's a local Audubon Society. There's so many different species, and I didn't realize there's as many bird calls as there are birds.
Well, that's true, and I'm not a bird. I've always loved birds, and I've always fed birds at my house and that, and I've been very happy to be part of introducing so much great variety of vegetation so that the birds that we do get, you know, the numbers, the variety greatly increases. And, in fact, the last 2 years, we do a bird walk on Migratory Bird Day in the spring, and go out for just an hour, like 7 o'clock in the morning, and I know they've been finding over 35 different types of birds just on that one short walk, and that's rain or shine. So we do have a good bird population out there.
Yeah, my favorite are the red-winged blackbirds, and I think I went to one meeting of the Audubon Society and said there are 23 variety of finches out there. What about the sites of the flowers? It seems like there are flowers continuously from what? From April through November? What variety of colors and types do you get?
Well, Josh, my restoration ecologist, does a survey for us, and he's always looking for new and different plants, and he knows them, and he can walk in the middle of the winter and point out a dead stick on the ground and tell you what it is. And I think his count now is like 360 different varieties of plants out there. Now, that's not all good, some bad, but the great majority of good plants, and these are, you know, new seeds that we've added there and everything. So we do have it's not just a monoculture. We have a great variety of vegetation out there. And if you walk there all the time, as I do, I mean, every week you see different flowers appearing. And, you know, the springtime is one of my absolute favorite times because along the creeks and that, you don't have all the tall grasses and other plants. You can see the nice creeks. But then at that time, my three favorite plants that come up in the spring are the skunk cabbage and the marsh marigolds and the angelica. And they're everywhere. And you go from having this, you know, after the snow is gone, everything's just dark and gray and dreary, and all of a sudden these beautiful yellow flowers start coming up, and the huge skunk cabbage and these giant angelica. In fact, right now there's a second generation of angelica that always comes up this time of the year.
What is the beautiful collection of purple and white that comes up about May? It just seems to explode with purple.
Well, actually, that's not a good one.
That's not a bad. That's a bad one.
It looks beautiful. It looks like phlox.
Yeah.
And it comes in purple and white, and that's actually Dame's Rocket. It's a member of the garlic mustard family, and that will take over woodlands. And it grows in more shady areas. And so many people tell me, oh, you're doing such a great job out here. It just looks beautiful when I walk. And we say, well, I agree with you, but it's not one of the good ones. And it's hard for me to remove it because it looks so beautiful. Garlic mustard, fine. You can get rid of that. There's nothing that pretty about that. But the Dame's Rocket, it's tough.
If you were going to use colors to describe, what colors of the rainbow do you see over the course of the year when you walk through, in addition to the purple and the white?
Well, it's mostly, you know, lots of different yellows, tans, blues, reds, cardinal flowers, and different things like that. But again, just a great variety that come and go. We just recently, after we finished our walk this morning, a couple had mentioned, oh, we just loved walking out here for the last 2-3 weeks when the purple prairie clover was coming up, which again is one of my favorites, and it's so neat when you're harvesting that seed because you just strip off the pod from where the flower was, and you get almost a whole handful of seeds. And it's a very, very beautiful flower, but you've got that for 3 weeks. So when that's gone, then the other things will come up, the brown-headed cone flowers or various different things. And again, right into the fall.
Big event coming up next month in August. What do you have on tap?
Well, August 13th, we're having the first of what we call a Kishwa Keto gathering. We're asking all of our friends, our contributors, our volunteers to bring more friends out, introduce them to Kishwa Keto. We're going to start out with some coffee and juice and some nice selection of pastries from that Jeanette Maxwell will be bringing from Daddy Maxwell's, and we'll mix and mingle and have our coffee and juice and for a half hour, and then at 9:30 we'll have a short meeting, you know, just 20 minutes of speeches, telling a little of the history and what our focus is, what has to be done, and where the money goes and our need for it. And then we will be offering either walking tours through the property, and we also have our gator we can take a couple people on, and we have a golf cart, so we'll be able to get people out to see the beautiful areas throughout Kishwa Keto. Whether they can walk or not, and try to get them out. Because once you get people out there and show you what you have, you know, so many people drive by in their car. And one of the neat, even with the car, when we were clearing along that plateau area right next to Highway 67, everybody would complain, oh, you're ruining the habitat again. But all of a sudden, you know, and none of this bothers me because I know you just have to be patient, and eventually they're going to see the rewards of what we've done. And all of a sudden, people would be saying, oh, I never realized how big Kishwa Keto was. I drive along now. I can see in through the forest, out to the prairie. And it's just another one of these, you know, evolving things. And they say, again, I not all of my life have been the most patient person in the world, but I have learned you have to with nature.
And in the minute or so left, what's the biggest need you have as far as people who could volunteer or help?
Well, just people that are willing to, give us many days throughout the year on the various projects. And our big thing is donations again, because after we bought the property, I said as long as I had anything to say about it, that we would not take any tax dollars. We would do it all through volunteer labor. Whatever we did, we do with volunteer labor and donations. And we have done that the entire time. Certainly the village, if we're planting some huge trees, they'll come in and let us use their backhoe to dig a hole here and there. But we've never been a line item on the budget, and we're proud of that, and we want to keep it that way. And by doing that, people get out and fall in love with it. That's why we do have a few events like our 5K race and that, to raise some money, but more so just to get different people out there. And every time you have an event like that, well, I never realized how beautiful this place is. And so It's become a treasure now, and that's how you want people to think of it, not as some negative thing. You want it to. It's sacred as far as I'm concerned, and I think many people feel that way. So, the key thing we did though was after buying it was. It took me 2 years to get to the village board to buy into my thought of the Geneva Lake Conservancy holding a conservation easement over the property as another layer of protection. So the village actually gave up any control over this, but all we gave to the Conservancy was they control it. Nothing can ever be built on it. And if it were to be sold, which you can't stop something from being sold, it could not be piecemeal where someone would come in and buy the 15